Next, Jane McAlevey. Jane has been on this show many times to discuss her approach to union organizing, an approach that's full of lessons for anyone wanting to do politics. Like, instead of making noble moral gestures, ask yourself instead what your theory of power is and what your points of leverage over existing power structures might be. Jane's latest book, No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age, was published last October by Oxford University Press. We're a little late getting to it, but much better late than never. Jane McAlevey. You make a very useful distinction among three approaches to political organization or political activity we can talk about. One is an advocacy model, one is a mobilization model, and the third is organizing, the one that you're really interested in. But tell us about this model, this unholy trinity of political action.
Yeah, sure. First of all, yeah, it's great to be here. It's always good to talk to you, Doug, and to be on your show. So advocacy, mobilizing, and organizing. Yeah, advocacy, which I think really developed into a dominant model in this country starting in the early 1970s, is essentially, you could say it's the Nader groups, it's something like Greenpeace. It's where a group of people, generally well-educated, full-time staff, you know, are paid money by someone to advocate for a cause on behalf of the cause or those affected by it. So that's advocacy.
If I want to put a class angle on this, it's as if the professional or a portion of the professional managerial class is hired to do work on behalf of the downtrodden.
Yes, for sure. And by the way, there is a class analysis to it, right? And I mean, interestingly, I quote Theda Skocpol's book, Diminished Democracy, in the very beginning of No Shortcuts, because she actually did some interesting analysis. I mean, she sort of, I didn't realize when I was reading that book of hers that she also called out the idea that there was this explosion of sort of, you know, working class kids who went off to college in the 1960s because of what happened with the GI Bill in the 1940s with vets coming home. So we have an explosion of the number of what we used to call the working class kids who went off to college in the 1960s who sort of discover, you know, the world. And they came out of college and the student, the anti-war movement, sort of thinking that they were really wicked smart, smarter, it turned out, than the ordinary working class. And they move into and set up this whole infrastructure of advocacy organizations. And they begin to think, hey, you know, we just need some money and we can sort of make sure that the laws that we passed in the 30s through the 60s, from clean air to Social Security to Medicaid and all that stuff, you know, we can, all we have to do is just go enforce them. And we can do that with some lawyers and some full-time do-gooders working for organizations. And we don't really need that messy thing called trade unions anymore. So that's, I think, the origins of the advocacy model in terms of it being something that came into the quote-unquote progressive movement, have their origins in that moment. And so I spend a lot of time on sort of the 1970s forward in terms of the critique of what we're doing wrong. By the mid-1990s or the post-Reagan moments, some people are beginning to realize, you know, it turns out it's not good enough just to have, you know, a bunch of well-trained lawyers and liberals in full-time staff positions in Washington advocating for, quote-unquote, on our behalf to get press and, you know, to get media attention and, you know, to be taken more seriously. We actually have to have some ordinary people involved. So the big argument in the book is that we evolved a sort of new model, which is called the mobilizing model. And that's what I'm trying to call out as super problematic today. And as part of the reason why we're in the mess we're in 2017 is because it used to be that people understood there was advocacy, lawyers, liberals, full-time staff working on behalf of others. That's sort of the do-gooder advocacy model. And then we thought there was organizing. And anyone who wasn't doing advocacy was doing organizing, which meant people were involved. We're actually relying on ordinary people to get involved, take action, do direct action. And what I'm pointing out in the book is that it's an illusion, and that actually what's happened is something called the creation of a mobilizing model. And in the mobilizing model, it actually still is full-time, college-educated, professional staff who are actually the key agents for change. It's just that in the mobilizing model, they understand that to create a good Twitter feed or a good narrative or if someone's going to testify at the legislature, it turns out it's more effective if the testimony is actually delivered by one of the poor and downtrodden, if you like.
Human props.
Yeah, it's people as props. So in the mobilizing model, like the theory of power isn't any different than in the advocacy approach. The theory of power is just an elite theory of power where elite do-gooders can go out and get the work done. It's just that workers become props. They involve some people. Who they're involving is sort of what I call the activist core. Those people who are already super committed to the campaign that we're trying to win. But what they're not fundamentally doing is actually enabling and empowering the masses of ordinary people to themselves learn that the only salvation is, in fact, themselves, right? Like, so in the organizing model, the theory of power, certainly the one that I'm still wedded to, and it's still working when we do it right, is a class struggle theory of power. The idea of the 1% versus the 99% has become like a passé slogan. It's like saying democracy or something these days, right? Like, sure, we're all for the 99%. First of all, we're not. Second of all, the question is, how do the 99%, or as I like to say, more like practically speaking, about 80%, how is it that the 80% of the masses actually become involved? They only become involved in a serious way when they're actually leading their own struggles. And so in the organizing model, the theory of power is actually quite different. It's not an elite theory of power. The theory of power is about the millions of people in this country who are taking it in the neck and losing everything right now themselves have to be empowered and skilled and trained to stand up and fight for themselves. To me, the biggest challenge is that people haven't understood that there's this thing called mobilizing going on, because everybody who's doing mobilizing says they're doing organizing. And the whole point of the new book is to say, no, you're not. And that's part of why we're in the giant mess that we're in today.
What you call the mobilizing model, it sounds a lot like the Fight for 15.
Well, sure. Absolutely. I mean, that's pretty much on a good day. I mean, some days it's just the advocacy model, honestly. And other days in other states, it functions mostly like a mobilizing model. And, you know, I've been known to be fairly critical of how the Fight for 15 campaign is being waged, and I haven't changed my opinion about that. But I do want to say it takes us to another segue, thinking about the Fight for 15 campaign, which is absolutely a mobilizing model, right? It's people as props. There are not right now thousands of low-wage workers making any decision and how anything in that campaign is happening. That's not who's making the decision. A handful of elite staff have always been making the key decisions, along with a couple of big PR firms, have always been the people who are making the decisions and who are therefore the central lead actors in that campaign, with a lot of hardworking, ordinary people serving as props. There's a limitation to the idea that the fast food campaign should be the center of all of our attention to begin with, which is the whole idea that there are strategic sectors that we have to be organizing in to challenge capitalism effectively. And I'm partly arguing that while it's good, like while it's good that people get raises and that's important, and of course it'd be idiotic to say it's not good that people get raises, if we want to go at the power structure of this country, we have to think carefully about which sectors of workers have the most capacity to build the kind of power that we need to build to actually challenge capital. And I hate to say that as good as it feels to do the Fight for 15 campaign, it's not the most important strategic sectors that we need to be organizing in. And that's part of the limitation of the whole campaign.
The focus on fast food workers sort of feeds into an attitude among philanthropists and, you know, elite do-gooders, professional do-gooders, that they're most interested in the weakest, poorest, most marginalized sectors of society. And actual power frightens them, I think. That target fits in. Now, they're not really looking to challenge the order. They're just doing to do a little old-fashioned upper-class uplift work.
Yeah, 100%. Bingo. Absolutely. That's exactly right. The philanthropic elite wouldn't be interested in challenging capital. It's an oxymoron, right? I mean, you wouldn't be in the philanthropic sector.
No, they'd be committing class suicide if they did that.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, as complicated as the trade union movement is, there isn't any day of the week when I wouldn't personally prefer to be being funded by the ordinary dues of hardworking workers who have made the decision to pay them. At least in a system where people are paying dues in theory, right, when workers themselves are actually paying dues and paying the salary of the folks who they hire, at least in theory, we understand the capacity is there to seriously challenge power and capital because it is the masses of the workers paying the bills.
Okay, and in contrast to these two deficient models, you propose organizing as the real way to go. Everyone will point out that we're not in the world of giant factories anymore and big industrial towns, and it's really hard to organize in an environment dominated by precarity and marginalization of the working class. You don't really buy that argument.
No, I don't buy that argument, and I don't buy it for a bunch of reasons. First, look, for all the blah, blah that the robots are coming, A, they're not here yet. Look, the same people who want us to get stuck in a do-gooder model of advocating on behalf of the poorest, most downtrodden, weakest sectors of our society are also the people who sort of throw out the same argument, right, that there's really nothing to be done here. In the 1930s, when we had a smart left building a serious trade union movement, we had strategic sectors. They were not actually just organizing willy-nilly every single, they weren't going to the buggy whip factory and organizing the buggy whip workers in the 1930s, right? That wasn't the theory. In today's economy, there are a whole bunch of strategic sectors where workers themselves still can hold power, where workers can still use the most powerful weapon that workers have, which is called the strike. There are still workers using the strike, and we need to be focused. Power building needs to happen in the sectors of the U.S. economy where workers still can have real agency, can still shut down the workplace and or do what I call creating a serious crisis for capital. For example, in the healthcare sector, right, when we strike, we don't actually shut it down because that'd be killing patients, but we create a full-time double payroll instantly for the employer and a very expensive double payroll during a strike that does, in fact, create a very, very serious crisis for capital in the act of healthcare worker strike. So in the case of the Chicago teachers, obviously, when they shut down, I mean, people say, like, teachers, really, teachers? You know, like, when they shut down the Chicago school system, they sure as hell created a crisis in the city of Chicago, and they did it for days on end. Let's just cut for a minute in this analogy to the idea of if you wanted to organize Walmart or you wanted to organize inside of sort of the retail sector. There's a bunch of people who have been trying to argue that the way to organize Walmart is not to go to the quote-unquote Walmart associates. It's to go to the supply chain. It's to go to the distribution centers. It's to go to trucking, ports, and the warehouses, where there are, in fact, stable workplaces that are fairly desperately needed by the same corporation that are not nearly as quickly or easily replaceable or as transient as sort of the front-of-the-house retail worker in the Walmart model.
I'm speaking with the writer and organizer Jane McAlevey, author of No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age from Oxford University Press. Yeah, well, with just-in-time inventory practice, you know, you can shut down Walmart in a matter of days.
Absolutely. So the point is, there are very clear strategic choices about ways that we could actually build power. Last year, I spent a lot of time working with a union called PASNAP, who's been doing some brilliant organizing in and around Philadelphia. But they're not the only one. But just as an example, a couple of weeks ago, 2 weeks ago now, 3 weeks ago, you know, they had a 100% out strike in Philadelphia. And I'm just wondering, Doug, did you read that in the New York Times that there was a 100% out worker strike in the city of Philadelphia in a hospital? No, because people don't want to pay attention to where workers are still striking. There are a lot of places in this country where there are still actually strikes happening. They're not massive factories that were shutting down, but they're actually 100% out strikes. And guess what happens when workers are still holding 100% out? No one's crossing the threshold of the workplace, total solidarity strikes. They win, right? We're winning when we do that still. So we have to be paying attention to the sectors of the economy where we can actually go at Walmart, like the supply chain, the distribution, all of those places, right? We have to do a power analysis and say, based on a power analysis, where are the sectors of the economy where the strategies that we understand how to use as organizers are still effective, and zero in on those sectors of the economy. Had we done anything like a Fight for 15-like effort in terms of money and resources focused on the right strategies inside of how to organize Walmart, I think we would have had a very different outcome in how to organize Walmart. The good news, I think, is that there are increasing numbers of sort of local unions in the education sector. There are a bunch of unions who took their inspiration from the Chicago teachers and are actually beginning to build real power. It's happening in Los Angeles, in UTLA, the United Teachers of Los Angeles. It happened in Seattle in the 2015 strike in Seattle that people heard way less about. In Massachusetts, The teachers union under reform leadership of Barb Mataloni last November, when all the disastrous news was hitting this country, like one bright spot, the defeat of a $35 million hedge fund funded campaign to charterize the public school system of Massachusetts. That was a ballot initiative that went 2-1 against a $35 million hedge fund funded out-of-state money campaign to privatize schools in the state of Massachusetts, because a left-led, you know, union where a reform slate began to have some real impact said, we're not going to compromise. We're going to defeat the charter school initiative. And there was a lot of internal debate in that union about whether or not they could do it. And had there not been the Educators for a Democratic Union, EDU, had they not won the presidency of that union, it's probably fair to say that there was a high likelihood that that union, under a more constrained sort of conservative teacher union leadership, was going to cut a deal with the governor, was going to say, okay, well, we'll just agree to raise the caps to a certain percentage of schools that can go charter in Massachusetts, and they would have done it. But instead, a progressive teacher union leader won election on the back of it's time to stand up to, you know, the attack that's coming at us. And she said, no, we actually can defeat them if we run a serious grassroots campaign and involve the whole community and all the teachers. And they did. And the polling, if they had listened to the morons in the Democratic Party consultant operation in Massachusetts, I was there doing some work with them, who were saying, you know, the polling's dead even, and that's not a good sign at this phase, and we think, you know, we think we're going to lose, so we should just cut a deal with Charlie Baker, the Republican governor, and the Democratic legislators, and let's just compromise and cut a deal to raise the cap on charter schools en masse. That's what would have happened. That's what a not forward-thinking teachers union leadership was about to do. And fortunately, a more left-led teachers union coalition took the presidency, and Barbara Mataloni was smart enough to say, hell no, we're not compromising. And in November, it was 2-1 against the hedge funders. That's the same decision that the Chicago teachers union leaders made, was to fight, not surrender, and they also won, right? So to me, it's like, there's almost an endless list of good examples right now of where, when people are doing real organizing, we're winning.
When you talk about organizing workers like this, you're going to hear someone say, but worker is just one part of a person's identity. People live multiple lives in their communities, this old-style organizing isn't really adequate to the way people live. That's anything but accurate critique of your work, but explain why it's not.
I think in the 1930s, we understood, the left leadership inside the trade union movements understood the same thing that those of us still winning today understand, which is that workers are not just workers. They are whole people. They have complicated, interesting lives. But the point of good organizing is to help make connections. It's to enable people to see that if they connect up all the various points of oppression in their lives right now, gentrification, they're getting kicked out of their housing, they had a decent apartment with stable rent for years, suddenly the, you know, the gentrifiers are coming to take their neighborhood. It turns out, as I say in my shortcuts, it turns out that when you start to explain to people that the CEO that they're fighting in their hospital fight is on the board of the Philadelphia, in the case of Philadelphia, is sitting on the board of the Philadelphia Industrial Development Corporation, which is where Wells Fargo, of all godforsaken banks, is coming in to finance the gentrification of their neighborhood, that their CEO is connected. When you help workers start to make the fundamental connections that the CEO they're fighting in the workplace is also responsible for the bad things happening in their kids' schools and in their neighborhood in terms of getting kicked out of their apartment complex, which is going to be demolished for some high rent, you know, studio apartments, people begin to get enabled into the fight in a different way. They come to start to realize they actually have to build a working class movement again to take control, not just of the workplace, but also of their neighborhood, their schools and their city and their country. And when we help workers make those connections, that's what organizing is about, helping people understand and see the connections between their third shift and the gentrifier coming into their neighborhood. They begin to fight differently. And I can tell you great stories from being in Philadelphia last year. What would happen when we would help workers begin to see the connections that were taking place between oppression at work and oppression in their neighborhood. And they changed, like the whole way that the workers came to see themselves and experience their fight. They're now not just activists, in a new union, in a new work, in a newly unionized workplace, they're now leading fights throughout Philadelphia. And I just got another email sent to me from the union in Philadelphia 2 days ago about a huge rally. And it was a picture of a bunch of the nurses that we helped organize unions last year, leading a huge rally with the mayor of the city, with Kinney, with a bunch of the elected leadership. And it was all the workers who just became to realize that they're not just leaders in the workplace. They're taking over Philadelphia. Like, they are becoming major leaders in trying to revitalize a movement in the city of Philadelphia. So organizing is about helping people make connections. And it's about connecting the various potential sources of power they have in their community together into one big fight.
We're just about out of time, but you're the victim of a patronizing and sexist review by my old pal Rich Yeselson of The Nation. Do you have any words you would like to address to Richard?
Oh, boy. One, it'd be good to if he read the book a little bit more carefully, because apparently he didn't read the book. Like, everything that we just talked about, which is the argument of the book, is about how do we rebuild a powerful movement, and it starts with actually giving agency to ordinary workers to enable them to fight. It'd be really helpful if any of that had been acknowledged. You know, he, in that review, yeah, I think sexist is definitely a really good word to use. I think he never mentioned a word of anything I'd ever done, which I find totally fascinating. And he gave these huge puffy introductions to the two guys about allegedly the campaigns they had won. I think it was really a pathetic review that didn't in any way acknowledge both the real ideas that I'm putting forward, the real arguments I'm making, and in fact, the real history of the work, including the campaigns in Philadelphia last year, where all of the same methods were being used and where I had the pleasure of working with thousands of people and tons of great organizers who just upended a whole labor market. Yeah, I think the review was misguided, off-based, sexist to the core. And it's like he didn't even actually read the core arguments in the book.
I met Yeselson through an email list of elite liberal pundits. And he shared a consensus among the participants that the left or liberals or whatever you want to call these folks is in a really structurally very weak position. All we can do is play defense. The right has the upper hand. And we shouldn't make demands and just hope to make the best of a bad situation. That is pretty much the opposite of what you're saying right now. What do you say to that pessimism?
First of all, it's pathetic. Good luck with that. Go try and build a movement on that, right? Maybe he missed the title of my first book, Raising Expectations, right? I mean, he has no faith in ordinary working class people. And if you start off with that, game over, right? Why don't you just sidle up next to Trump for f***'s sake? Seriously, I mean, the first rule of being a good organizer is that you actually have to believe in the capacity of ordinary people to take tremendous action. And I do. And part of the reason why good organizers are still winning fights, like the fight we won in Philadelphia and like the fight that the teachers just won, whether it was Chicago, Seattle, Los Angeles, or in Massachusetts, you can't possibly imagine a route back to victory in this country if you don't believe in the capacity of ordinary people. Organizers do. We help enable them to realize the power that they have. And every one of us who are still doing real organizing work in this country are still winning, even in 2017. So the sooner that the Yeselsons get out of the way and realize, you know, he basically says in that review that I didn't have any big ideas compared to the two boys whose names I'm not even mentioning that he compared me to, right? And it's like, the evidence is in the work, brother. Go look at what happened in Philadelphia last year where thousands of workers stood up and won and where they are now taking on the power structure of the city of Philadelphia. Go look at Illinois where the Chicago Teachers Union has almost single-handedly, because of the work they did in building a movement in that state, held Bruce Rauner back from turning Illinois into Wisconsin or into Indiana or into Michigan. Like, ask Rich Yeselson, with Rauner there, now why didn't Illinois become the next Wisconsin or the next Michigan? Why hasn't it still happened? Because ordinary teachers built one hell of a movement, and they have yet to let Bruce Rauner do to Illinois what happened in neighboring states where you had weak unions who were just circling the, building the fortress, as he called it, I think, right? That didn't work very well in Wisconsin and Michigan. And the model of movement building and empowering ordinary teachers who went out and built a hell of a movement has actually held back the biggest hedge fund guy in Illinois. So the proof is in the pudding, and he just needs to get out of the way of people who are actually trying to get the work done.
I was a union organizer and writer, Jane McAlevey. Her book is No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age, from Oxford University Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, Stefan Grappelli doing a jazz hot take on the Internationale. Till next week, bye.